We arrive here today to debate at social distances from each other.
There's no doubt that the old politics of the two-party system is now gone and over.
I don't need lectures from you or anybody on the Sinn Féin side of the house.
We're very reluctant to say what's red lines, but we do have to take climate seriously.
There's going to be constant criticism, there's going to be a lot of disappointment, and whoever goes into government is going to be unpopular.
Okay. Hello, and you're very welcome to RTÉ News' Your Politics Podcast, the podcast that tries to get behind the headlines and tell you what's really happening with the decision makers and why they do what they do. Joining me, two high flyers, Sandra Hurley from our political unit and also David Murphy, our political assignments editor. I think if you take a step back and look at 2020, it's not just what COVID did to this country and ground it to a halt, but probably also how the population, Sandra Hurley, took on board some of these incredible restrictions placed by government and in the vast majority of cases just did what they were told to do. We're now entering a new phase as we approach Christmas. Where are we going?
Yeah, I mean, on your first point, I mean, I think in general, we're pretty compliant, really, aren't we? I think
we're very
most people, yeah, pat on the back, we're great. Yeah, most people, I mean, these are enormous restrictions. None of us have ever lived through this before. And everyone, vast majority, knuckled down and just got on with it and adapted to these kind of escalating restrictions throughout the year. So where are we now? Well, things are going to be eased up tomorrow until January 6th. That's the plan at the moment, that people can have household visits, they can travel around the country. But the question is whether the government can maintain that over the Christmas period. We are being warned that all the indicators are going in the wrong direction. We're hearing that from everybody. So I think there's no question that the government is going to pull back on tomorrow's changes. But the problem is after Christmas. I think that's when things possibly could change. We know that there's a cabinet meeting. There's one next week, but there's one on the 29th of December. And at that stage, they will have a lot more detail about what's been happening with the numbers. And they might have to make a choice at that point about whether to continue that relaxation until January 6th, or whether they say to people, you've had Christmas, we're going to have to pare it back now.
I mean, I just saw a tweet yesterday from Fergal Bowers in which he said, no COVID-19 outbreaks have been reported linked to cafes, restaurants or public houses in the past 2 weeks, according to the latest data from the HPSC. So to a certain extent, is there a confidence within the government that they can approach Christmas, that even though the numbers might be going in the wrong way, as Sandra said, that we're not heading to Armageddon?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on here. And if you think about the way people behave at this time of year, often
speak
really
for
Christmas.
Well,
Christmas is with the family, let's face it. Yeah. And New Year's is often spent with your pals. And if we look at the language that the Taoiseach has used in the past, he's spoken about a meaningful Christmas, but a different type of Christmas. Mm-hmm. And really, I think what it's about is allowing people to go to where they're from, to go, you know, back to their home county, to be able to spend Christmas with their family in really careful circumstances where there aren't a lot of people there, ensuring that they're trying to be as cautious as they possibly can. I think Sandra's probably right in terms of the political atmosphere here in Leinster House. It seems to be moving towards that kind of caution around the New Year's part of the holiday. And to a certain extent, we can see that they've given themselves until January the 6th with the new set of restrictions which come into place tomorrow, that they would remain in place until January the 6th. But if we do see the COVID-19 numbers continuing to escalate, I think that's where perhaps we'd see more restrictions imposed, that they would cut back on the amount of flexibility people are given around New Year's.
I mean, it is a tough one, Sandra Hurley, when you're talking about how politicians and indeed the wider medical community is able to keep saying the same thing over and over again, and the ability of the population to listen to it or to discard it. Pascal Donoghue, the finance minister, was on RTÉ's News at One, and he was talking about the lifting of restrictions. And he said, you can meet more people, but that doesn't mean you have to meet everyone you know. So it was like a new way of saying the same thing, which we've heard for months. How are they going to be able to deal with this just over those next few weeks?
Yeah, I think they've been trying to manage expectations, really, in terms of telling people that, yes, you can see your family over Christmas, but this message of every contact counts. don't go mad. You know, they've been telling us you can go to the restaurant, but don't go to another bar afterwards and meet some more friends so you're not spreading it around so much. So they are trying to pare it back. And yes, I would agree, there's fatigue because everyone's been listening to this for so long. There's fatigue about restrictions coming on and then being lifted and what you're supposed to do in the middle of all of that. And it's a difficult message, I think, for all of them to sell.
Okay, let's move on here just because we've got quite a lot to talk about. And I want to talk about the word bailout. And I was looking, doing a bit of research, David Murphy, and bailout, according to the dictionary, is an act of giving financial assistance to a failing business or economy to save it from collapse.
Discuss. Yeah, so basically this all became a big issue in the Doyle this week when Micheál Martin said the banks weren't bailed out in response to Richard Boyd Barrett of People Before Profit, who was questioning why the banks had got money and yet there was nothing for Debenhams workers, in his words. So the issue really here is what exactly was bailed out. Micheál Martin said it was the bank shareholders who were not bailed out.
Which is a fact.
Which is a fact. However, the banks were bailed out. There is absolutely no doubt about that.
Could I not put it to you, as I don my legal gown, put it to you that
I'm getting nervous.
We bought the banks, and on that basis, we had a certain, there was an asset value part of that money which went on to the bondholders who were bailed out. So it was the bondholders bailed out, not the banks. That seems to be the argument.
I think it's a bit more complicated than that. And the thing we've got to remember is that it is true we did buy the banks. Effectively, what we did is we bought new shares in the banks. But in reality, that was just a mechanism to give the banks money. And yes, it is true to say a lot of that money went to repay bondholders. But that's not the only thing it was used for. It was also used for recapitalizing the banks. And this is the chunk of money that banks retain in the event that people can't pay their loans. To make sure the bank doesn't go bust, it sets aside a big, big chunk of capital. And the bigger the chunk of capital the bank has, the more confidence there would be in that bank. So essentially what the Irish government did is they took a big chunk of money, 64 billion euro, and they used that to rescue the financial system. And in reality, they were only able to keep half of it alive afterwards. We went into the financial crash with six financial institutions. We came out with three financial institutions. Anglo and Irish Nationwide were liquidated. EBS was taken over by AIB.
One last question just on this particular thing before I move back to Sandra. You used the number 64 billion.
Yes.
But we do know that we got some money back.
Yes.
From some sales. We know that we're due to get some money back from bank shares if we sell off AIB and Bank of Ireland. So how much is it actually going to cost us, can you say?
This is a really interesting and complicated question. However, the simple version pretty much goes like this. There are two large banks left, AIB and Bank of Ireland. The state has 72% shareholding in AIB. It has a 14% shareholding in Bank of Ireland. There's a smaller bank left, Permanent TSB. The state has a 70% holding in that. The combined value of the AIB and Bank of Ireland, according to the National Treasury Management Agency annual report, is about 17 billion euro. Then on top of that, Irish Life was sold. The state recouped 1.3 billion euro from that. It also recouped 3.5 billion euro from the sale of a 28% stake in AIB. And then there's been various dividend payments and payments in relation to preference shares on top of that. However, the real answer to this question probably won't come for another 10 or 15 years. When we decide, or when the states decide, it wants to sell off all of its shareholdings in the banks, because in reality, the state isn't in the business of owning banks. So potentially it could cost Ireland something in the region of 40 billion euro when you take account of everything. But we don't know yet, and there's a long way to go.
Sandra, just returning to the political issue here, it was Micheál Martin who sort of launched this particular rocket, and the opposition were deriding him, saying if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, then it is a duck. The banks were bailed out. Mm-hmm. And then Micheál Martin seemed to say today that he was saying it was a duck all the time.
Yeah, great analogy there, Paul. Yeah, I mean, I think it was a total own goal by the Taoiseach yesterday, and it seemed to be reinforced by some comments made to the papers through one of his spokespeople today. However, he has since spoken to the Cork Echo local paper and said that he did misspeak and that the banks were bailed out, and he was making a point about the shareholders. And the Taoiseach, the Leo Varadkar, made the same point in the Dáil today. However, Sinn Féin and Labour have called for him to correct the record. Within his own party, I'm not detecting that much of an appetite.
Yeah, not much of the PP last night.
Yeah, I met somebody today who's a very vocal critic of his.
Who?
I can't say, Paul. But he said that he misspoke. It's not that big a deal. Everyone knows the banks were bailed out. He didn't really want to push it any further. So that said, is it going to haunt Micheál Martin for time to come? It's the kind of clip that's gone viral already. It's a very simple one to understand. And I think when it comes to sort of political controversy, sometimes it's the simple ones that translate in a wider way to sort of the broader population.
Okay, David, let's leave that there and move on to another hardy annual, I was going to say annual, it's 4.5 years now of a Brexit. We were talking last week and the whole cloud hanging over the studio was that we could be heading to a no deal. It could be the worst possible outcome. Roll on a week, suddenly we're talking about it's going to be a deal and it's going to happen by Sunday.
Yeah, there's an expression in Brussels that, you know, everything in Brussels starts with big ideas and ends up in a row about fish. And I think you could probably say the same about Brexit. There's still a number of outstanding issues, but it does seem all the mood music coming from Brussels does seem to indicate that they're edging closer and closer to a deal. But it ain't over till it's over. And earlier today, we'd Michael Gove saying that he thought the chances of a deal were less than 50%. Now, perhaps he was only trying to keep people in his own party happy, the hard Brexiteers. But it does seem as if it is edging closer to a deal, which is going to be very good news for Ireland, because already the issue of the border has been sorted out. So the next big, big thing has been the question of tariffs for people selling goods into the UK and importing goods from the UK. If there is a deal, those tariffs will be dealt with and you would have a free trade deal. And that is absolutely crucial for the Irish economy.
Hey, Sandra, this idea that the border issue was sorted out last week, we did have that funny, strange bill rolling through the House of Commons, which was going to break international law just for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then it folded like a house of cards. Mr. Gove went in to negotiate with his opposite number and all of those clauses within the bill had suddenly disappeared. And it turned out that the bulletproof deal that Leo Varadkar did a few years back is in fact bulletproof. But I wonder in practice how it's going to work out, or what do you get a sense of from sort of from both sides of the border where people feel this is going to be, or is it just impossible to know?
I think what happened in terms of the ironing out on the Northern Ireland Protocol, it really reinforced the view that it was the whole time a sort of negotiating ploy by Boris Johnson.
Which because, we thought pretty much.
Yeah, which people had kind of said they were going to break international law in a time-limited way, whatever that means. But certainly it reinforced that view that many had held all along and that it was just a little trick that they had put up their sleeves. In terms of how it's going to work in practice, I think it's a little unclear for people who cross the border and who trade, you know, every single day in practice. Would there be kind of a transition sort of period, another one where things aren't fully implemented from January 1st? That's not totally clear yet. So I think a lot of the detail needs to emerge.
I suppose one thing, and just our last commentary on Brexit, David, is that if you spin back as far as 2016 and when we were talking about Brexit and what Brexit might mean, and then roll back to now, we are talking about the hardest possible Brexit there could be. This is the UK outside of the customs union, outside of the single market, with the thinnest possible deal. I mean, this is what they call a bare bones deal. So there's an awful lot to be concerned about when it comes to the Irish economy moving into 2021.
I think so. I mean, if we go back to Theresa May's famous phrase, Brexit means Brexit, and a lot of people didn't really know what it meant. And in terms of the single market and the customs union, that's really the cornerstone of the EU. And it is true they are going for a hard Brexit, and that will have implications. And also it's going to have implications for the way Europe conducts its business in future. In many ways, Ireland had many shared policies with the UK, and now it's had to find new friends at the table and it's had to build new diplomatic links.
because Britain isn't part of the EU anymore. I think as well, it'll be interesting to see how the UK economy does and to what extent it's affected by all of this. If there is, it really comes down to whether or not there's a trade deal. As you say, the indications are looking better at the moment, but still, you'd have to worry about the way in which this is being rushed through because it's such a monumental decision. The document's going to be in around 800 pages. We haven't seen it yet. It's going to be translated into 27 languages and it's going to go before the European Parliament. They're going to vote on it. The MEPs are at the moment indicating that they need more time to be able to consider it. And if a deal doesn't land by Sunday, that they won't have sufficient time to consider it. Other people really think that the European Parliament will basically do what other European governments tell them to do. And where there's a will, there's a way. And they'll get rammed through one way or another because the threat to the European economy more broadly of there being no deal or something being held up just because of procedure is just too big a risk to take.
We've talked about COVID, one of the big issues of 2020, Brexit, the bailout, which has made a sort of a journey back in time. One of the other big issues, Sandra Hurley, was the question of judicial appointments, how we appoint our judges, the degree of political influence, and this concept, whether it exists or not, of separation of powers between those relevant institutions. There's been some developments on that today. Can you tell us about them?
Well, earlier in the week as well, as today, I suppose, the government unveiled its new version of the Judicial Appointments Commission. And this was very controversial in the last all. Shane Ross was trying to push this through. There was massive pushback, especially in the Shannon, and it basically got held up.
The filibuster.
Yes, exactly. And for 18 months, and it lapsed then when the Dáil was dissolved. And what the government unveiled earlier in the week is a different composition for the commission. It's now going to be chaired by the Chief Justice. It's going to have an equal number of lay members and judicial members, although the AG will sit in an advisory role. And what they will do is they will send a maximum of 5 names to the government. But a few key points here. They're not going to be ranked. And that was something that Shane Ross had looked for last time round. So the government really is absolutely going to retain the prerogative in terms of who they appoint. Those names will then go to government. The Minister for Justice will consult with coalition party leaders and bring one name to cabinet. And what the opposition have been saying, in the form of Sinn Féin in particular, Martin Kenny, is that this isn't going to get us any closer to any type of trail or any way of tracking how judges are appointed, because really the government, in a kind of secretive way, are still going to be able to make that choice entirely. He says the bill doesn't go far enough and they're going to put down a lot of amendments. So that's one part that happened earlier this week. And then today, Alan Kelly raised some stuff in the Dáil.
Stuff. I'm sure you might have a problem with that now.
Yeah, let's elaborate on the word stuff. The Department of Justice released a lot of documents last night in relation...
300 pages.
Yes, 300 pages. Some of them repeating. I had a look through them on the process of appointing a new judge to the Supreme Court. And that person, of course, was Seamus Wolfe. A few interesting points emerged from that. One, Frank Clark is looking for basically bigger numbers on the Supreme Court. They haven't got enough to handle the workload at the moment. And he wrote actually on the 4th of February during the election campaign saying, I know the timing is awkward, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, we've got 2 vacancies pretty much. Can you fill some of these? The then Minister for Justice, Charles Flanagan, wrote back and said that he couldn't promise that it would be done at the moment and they'd probably have to wait for another, for the new government to be formed. There was a lot of pushback as well from officials saying that the timing wasn't right and that they couldn't do it until the new government was in place. Alan Kelly raised some of the separate details that emerged, which were that in relation to the timeline of how Helen McEntee brought that one name to cabinet, she'd already been into the Dáil about this. It now seems that on the 6th of July, that a memo was prepared for cabinet. So it looked like she was ready to make the appointment at that stage. The problem is that she had already told the Dáil that she didn't talk to the other coalition party leaders until sometime between the 11th and the 14th of July. Now, in the event that memo from the 6th of July was pulled, the appointment was made on the 15th.
David Murphy, when it comes to the sort of the broader plan, whatever about this issue of going back onto Seamus Wolfe, onto the broader plan of judicial appointments, how do you see it carrying?
Well, you know, I think if you stand back and think about it for a moment, why is it that there's a close relationship between politics and judicial appointments? Why is it people are members of political parties and then perhaps they're favoured in terms of political appointments? In other areas, it's completely separate. If when the government goes and appoints someone to run, for instance, the central bank, it's not a case that that person is actually connected with any political party. However, with judges, it's completely different. People like Seamus Woolfe were known to be involved in Fine Gael, for instance. There are other people who are involved in political parties with the express purpose of being close to a political party who might be in government, and that puts them apparently on the ladder towards promotion. So, you know, I think that the government had an opportunity here to kind of sever the connection between politics and judicial appointments. And now that they've set up a mechanism whereby a list of five names goes to a Minister for Justice, that connection hasn't been severed. What Shane Ross was trying to do for some time was set up a completely independent process to appoint members of the judiciary. What we have now is something where there remains that connection between politics and the judiciary. That's something that has landed this government and previous governments into trouble in the past.
It does sound like a different motion insofar as that, as we learned when it came to Helen McEntee, she was completely, totally and utterly on her own. And there were just names. And we had these three different groups of names. The names that had been submitted, the names of people who were ready to go. And then you also had this separate mechanism. So we had, like, does this advance things, though? Whatever about the idea of severing the link, does it advance things from the way things currently stand?
It's certainly cleaner and it is certainly an improvement. I think what we learnt about the appointment of Seamus Woolfe to the Supreme Court is that the current system is very messy and in radical need of an overhaul. Furthermore, there's no proper mechanism to deal with members of the judiciary when there's a problem. You either have to impeach them, which involves a very long and rigorous process in the Doyle, which sometimes looks as if it could take perhaps a year or two to remove someone from the bench. However, when there are less serious issues, there's no way to reprimand, for instance, a member of the judiciary. So there's still a long way to go to modernise how the judiciary is managed in the Irish state.
And just on that, I would say it streamlines the process. I would agree with David on that. But what it doesn't do, the government has been defending, well, I put some of these questions to Helen McEntee earlier this week, and she said, you know, they're saying that in the Constitution, obviously, it's the president who appoints a judge, but on the recommendation of government. So they're saying the government has always had that prerogative and it's in the Constitution. But the advisory body, which they're putting in place, could have more of an input. And that's where the ranking really comes in. And I think that's where the advisory body and taking politics out of it, as you talk about it, they could have played a greater role. And the government is not willing to go that far at the moment. And that's very clear.
I wonder why not.
I wonder why not. As David said, and this is a very cynical view, people join political parties maybe for advancement. And a lot of lawyers in particular are members of political parties. Now, the governments would point to some people who were appointed to, I think Frank Clark is one. He's a known Fine Gael member. He was appointed by a Fianna Fáil government. So it doesn't always tally, but there have been problems certainly along the way.
I think one of the issues is that, you know, when we've seen members of the judiciary in office, we haven't seen them act in a politically partisan way. I think that's probably worth pointing out in all of this. But at the same time, their close connections with political parties can sometimes give people the wrong impression. And I guess it's not just a question of being cleaner than clean. It also has to look cleaner than clean. And the problem is the system at the moment leaves itself open to question because of those close connections between politics and the judiciary.
Okay, just say this is one of our last podcasts, if not the last podcast, depending on what happens with Brexit over the next couple of days. I'm just thinking, Sandra, if you're looking at issues ahead going into 2021, what do you think is things people should be watching out for?
Well, it's a really obvious thing to say, but the vaccine, the rollout of the vaccine. I mean, everything depends on the rollout of the vaccine. And I think, obviously, what it's really important for is protecting people's lives and reopening society and the economy. But just step back and look at it politically. For Micheál Martin, I think in particular, this is his moment to have this massive impact in a real way on people's lives if it can be successfully managed, that we get enough supplies of the vaccine, that there's a feeling that it was done fairly in terms of the prioritisation, if it works and if society gets back open, say, by next summer. It's a real legacy issue, and especially for somebody who we know, and we haven't seen this before, is going to be out of office in 2 years' time. I mean, other people have faced elections, but he is going because of that time limit on his role.
Davis, what's your thing? You can't say vaccine because she said it already.
Yes, I took the good one.
Ah, come on. I think, you know, obviously the issue of the economy and at what point they're going to be able to open up. Obviously, with the vaccine rolling in, there will be pressure mounting as people get vaccinated and as the COVID numbers begin to come downwards in the first half of next year. There will be pressure to open up, and at what point it's going to be safe to do that. I think there's going to be a huge element of fatigue with this. It was interesting listening to Pascal Donoghue, the finance minister, at lunchtime, saying that the pandemic unemployment payment, the level of that is going to remain the same into next year, and clearly the level of restrictions is going to be pretty similar. The other big issue coming up next year is what exactly is going to happen with Brexit, what's going to be our relationship with the UK, and then the other thing as well is we're going to have a new president in the White House, Joe Biden. I think perhaps his presence has made itself already felt in the way that the UK has handled the question of the border in relation to the Brexit negotiations. So all of those different dynamics are going to play out. And perhaps as well on an international field, we'll see the way the US is going to perhaps re-engage with international institutions and re-engage with the question of the environment in a way perhaps it didn't under Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that interaction between the vaccine, between Brexit and opening up the economy are going to be, is like the triangle around which everything pivots, and particularly when it comes to Brexit. I know so many people are sick to death with it, getting a blow-by-blow accounts and thinking if there's a deal, that's it. But that's probably only the beginning of it.
Yeah, I think Brexit's going to be a bit like COVID. It's going to be around a lot longer than we think.
That's not a very optimistic note to conclude our podcast, but we've run completely out of time. I'd like to thank Sandra Hurley and David Murphy. Thanks very much for listening to RTÉ News' Your Politics podcast. Please do subscribe. Please do leave some comments. We love to hear from you. Until the next time, take care.